Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. We are diving deep today into, well, a real paradox at the heart of some severe neurological disorders. Think about a disease like Huntington's HD. Why does the age someone starts showing symptoms vary so much, sometimes by decades? You could have two people, maybe even siblings, who inherited the exact same core mutation, you know, the same expanded length of that CAG repeat, yet one gets sick at 35, and the other might not show signs until they're 65. How does that work?
Yeah, that's the classic 60-40 problem that geneticists have been grappling with for ages. We know the inherited repeat size, the pure length, that determines a big chunk, maybe 60% of the variation in when the disease starts. Longer repeat, generally earlier onset, that part seems clear.
Okay, but that leaves a huge chunk, 40%, completely unexplained just by that inherited length.
Exactly. And the really surprising thing is that this 40% seems to be heavily influenced by tiny little tweaks in the sequence, sometimes just one or two base pair changes inside that big expanded repeat track itself.
And these are what we call sequence interruptions.
That's right. And they're not just random noise. These interruptions are really powerful disease modifiers. Gaining them can potentially add decades of healthy life.
Wow.
But losing them can dramatically speed up the disease onset. So that genetic instability within that 40%, that's what we're trying to really nail down today.
Okay, let's unpack this then. If these interruptions are so critical for changing disease severity, sometimes even between parents and children, they must be pretty dynamic, right?
Highly dynamic.
So our mission today is to figure out the mechanism, what allows these really important sequence bits to be gained or lost or even completely rearranged within our genome.
And this deep dive is based on a really important opinion piece that pulls together a lot of recent findings in genetics. It proposes a kind of unified framework for how these interruptions might work. So today we're celebrating the work of Ellis-Anne Aston and Vincent Dion. They're at the UK Dementia Research Institute at Cardiff University, and they've really pushed forward our understanding of these repeat expansion diseases and the dynamics of interruptions.
Great. So to set the stage, maybe give us a bit more context. We're talking about a whole class of diseases here, right?
Yeah, over 60 neurological, neuromuscular, and even developmental disorders. And they're all caused by these expanded tandem repeats, basically. Mm-hmm. Simple DNA sequences that have just grown way too long, pathologically long.
And it's not just that they're long, it's that they're unstable.
That's the key. Their fundamental instability is what makes them pathogenic. So, yes, the length you inherit matters a lot, but then there's lifetime somatic expansion. The repeats keep growing, keep getting longer over time, especially in affected tissues like the brain.
And that continued expansion seems critical for the disease to actually manifest clinically.
Absolutely. And this expansion process is heavily tied into how the cell deals with DNA stress, particularly the DNA mismatch repair pathway. That seems to be a major driver.
And why are these repetitive sequences so prone to expanding in the first place?
Well, structurally, they're kind of a nightmare for DNA stability. When the replication machinery tries to copy these long repetitive tracks, the simple repeats tend to fold up into weird, unstable shapes, non-BDNA secondary structures, things like slip strands or hairpins.
Okay.
And these odd structures can essentially trick the cell's machinery into adding more repeats during replication or repair. That's how they expand.
Right, so they create these problematic shapes. And interruptions, then?
Interruptions are like putting a spanner in the works, molecularly speaking. They break up the monotony of the repeat. By inserting a different sequence, they disrupt the formation of those unstable secondary structures.
So the machinery is less likely to slip or get confused.
Exactly. The classic example, as you mentioned earlier, is in Huntington's disease. The CAG repeat can have a CAA interruption. And having that CAA significantly reduces somatic expansion in mouse models. It also seems to lower the risk of the repeat expanding further when it's passed down to the next generation.
Okay, so if interruptions break up the bad structure, they generally lead to a milder outcome, like delaying the onset of HD. Seems straightforward.
You'd think so. But here's the paradox, and it's a big one. Interruptions don't always make things better.
Oh.
No. The effect really depends on the specific disease, the location, and what the interruption sequence actually is. Take spinocerebellar ataxia type 8, or SEA8. In that case, having CCG interruptions within the repeat seems to actually increase the toxicity of the protein that gets made.
So the interruption makes the disease worse in that context?
It appears so, yes.
Yeah.
leads to a more severe clinical outcome compared to someone with a pure repeat of the same length.
Huh. Okay, that complicates things.
And it gets even wilder with spinocerebellar ataxia type 10, SEA10. There's evidence suggesting that in some people, having a long pure repeat might not even be pathogenic, or at least it's low penetrance. In those cases, the disease seems to be driven not by the length itself, but by the presence of specific interruptions within the repeat.
So the interruptions themselves become the culprits, not just modifiers.
Precisely. It flips the whole script. They're not just protective breaks anymore. They're powerful sequence elements that act in cis right there on the same molecule and can be the primary driver of disease.
Okay, wow. This really highlights why we need a mechanism that can explain how these very specific sequences get created and also how they get lost. It's clearly not random.
For a long time, the main idea kicking around was based on replication, the Okazaki fragment slippage model.
Right, the idea that during DNA replication, especially on the lagging strand, the polymerase might slip and reanneal incorrectly.
Yeah, causing it to maybe skip over a bit or add an extra copy of the repeat, potentially including or losing an interruption in the process.
And that seemed plausible.
It was plausible for simple changes, like losing or gaining a single repeat unit that matched the interruption, but it had major limitations. It really couldn't explain the incredibly complex alleles we started finding with better sequencing.
Complex alleles, like what?
Like alleles with multiple different types of interruptions, or interruptions that were completely unrelated in sequence to the main repeat unit. For example, finding an ATTTTT sequence inside a pentanucleotide repeat in SEA10.
Replication slippage can't just invent a sequence like that out of nowhere.
Exactly. It just doesn't have the capability to generate that kind of complex insertion or rearrangement.
So we need something else. Something that's maybe error-prone enough to create new sequences, but also structured enough that it tends to create the same specific interruptions over and over again at certain locations.
Right. And this is where the authors bring in this alternative mechanism. And honestly, this is where it gets really interesting. They propose synthesis-dependent microhomology-mediated end joining.
SDMMEJ. Okay, that's a mouthful.
It is. But the concept is actually quite elegant. We're talking about an alternative DNA repair pathway. It's known to be highly error-prone. And it relies on a specific enzyme, DNA polymerase theta, pol theta.
Okay, and it's for repairing what kind of damage?
Severe damage, specifically double-strand breaks in the DNA. Think of it as one of the cell's emergency repair kits.
Like a quick and dirty patch-up job when the main systems are overwhelmed or can't work?
That's a good analogy. Pol theta is like the handyman grabbing whatever's nearby to stitch the broken ends back together quickly. It's often messy, but it seals the break.
And how does it stitch things together?
Unlike some other repair pathways that need long stretches of identical sequence, SDMMEE uses very short sequences, just 1 to 6 base pairs long. These are called micromologies, or ME. It also uses something called primer repeats.
Microhomology, the tiny little bits of matching sequence.
Tiny bits, yeah. It uses these to kind of line up the broken ends, maybe imperfectly, and then pol theta synthesizes new DNA to fill any gaps. But because it's using these tiny anchors and it's not very precise, the side effect is that it often creates small insertions or deletions right at the repair site.
Ah, so the errors are insertions and deletions generated during the repair.
Precisely, yeah. And it seems SDMMEJ works in a couple of main ways, or modes, which can influence the kind of insertion you get.
Okay.
There's the loop-out model. Here, the strands separate after the break. Then one strand might find a little primer repeat sequence nearby, but maybe out of register.
So it loops out a bit of sequence.
Right. It re-engages out of register. Pol theta starts synthesizing from there. And the end result is an insert that often creates direct repeats in the final structure.
Okay. And the other mode?
The snapback model. In this one, a single strand of DNA at the break site folds back onto itself.
Using itself as a template.
Exactly. It finds a little microhomology within itself, snaps back, prime synthesis, and this typically creates an insertion that results in inverted repeats.
So both modes create insertions, but maybe different kinds of structures.
Yes, they both generate complexity.
Yeah.
SDMMEJ is associated with insertions that can be up to 100 base pairs long, although the median size is quite small, around 5 base pairs.
Which fits with pol theta being maybe not super processive. It doesn't synthesize long stretches accurately.
That's the idea. Low processivity fits with these smaller error-prone insertions.
Okay, so we have this messy, error-prone repair pathway, SDMMEJ, that creates insertions and deletions using microhomology. How does that explain the very specific patterns of interruptions we see in patients?
Right, that's the crucial connection the authors make. This mechanism has to account for the specific characteristics that we've observed, especially with better long-read sequencing data now available.
What are those key characteristics?
Well, the first big one is locus specificity. We see the same repeat motif, say CAG, behaving differently depending on where it is in the genome.
Like the example you gave earlier.
Exactly. CAG at the ATT gene locus, involved in Huntington's, strongly prefers getting CAA interruptions. But the CAG repeat at the ATXNIC1 locus for SCA1 often gets CKA interruptions instead.
So the neighborhood matters. The surrounding DNA sequence must be playing a role.
It really suggests that, yes. The second point is directionality or location.
Where the interruptions tend to appear.
Yeah. They aren't usually scattered randomly through the middle of the repeat tract. More often, they're found clustered near the edges, the 5' and 3' flanks.
Okay.
We see that pattern pretty consistently at loci, like HTT for Huntington's, FMR1 for Fragile X, and DMPK for myotonic dystrophy. Always near the boundaries.
Interesting. What else?
The third major observation is the existence of these incredibly complex alleles. The changes we see across generations aren't always simple.
You mean it's not just gaining or losing one standard interruption?
Far from it sometimes. The classic example comes from a family study of myotonic dystrophy type 1 DM1.
What did they find?
It's quite amazing. The ancestor in the study had a pure CTG repeat. Simple enough.
Okay.
But in the very next generation, their child inherited an allele that had already picked up two CCG interruptions.
Just like that, in one generation.
Yep. And then, wait for it, by the third generation, the descendant had an extremely complex allele structure with six distinct interruptions.
Six. From 0 to 2 to 6 in 3 generations.
Exactly. The structure of that allele changed dramatically, suggesting multiple complex rearrangement events happening relatively quickly, generation after generation. It wasn't just a single mistake.
Wow. That really points towards some kind of ongoing dynamic process.
Absolutely. And that leads directly to the fourth characteristic, recurrence.
Meaning these specific changes happen again and again?
Yes. They aren't unique, one-off random mutations.
Yeah.
The loss of that protective CAA interruption at the HTT locus, which makes Huntington's worse. That's seen repeatedly in different families on different genetic backgrounds. Similarly, the gain of CCG interruptions at the DMPK locus in myotonic dystrophy is also a recurrent event. These specific changes happen repeatedly.
Okay, so we have locus specificity, directionality, complex alleles, and recurrence. That's the evidence the SDMMEJ model needs to explain.
Right, and what's really compelling about the proposal is how SDMMEJ seems capable of accounting for all four. It links this potentially messy repair pathway to these highly specific outcomes.
How does it explain locus specificity then? Why CAA at HTT, but CAA at ATXN1?
Well, if the repair event relies on SDMMEJ, then the surrounding genomic sequence becomes critical because the whole process is templated, in part, by microhomology. The model suggests locus specificity arises because the de novo synthesis step during repair is primed by and copy sequence from the DNA immediately adjacent to the repeat tract, the flanking sequences.
Ah, so the flanks provide the template for the type of interruption that gets inserted.
That's the core idea. The available microhomology in the sequence in the flanks essentially dictate which specific bases get incorporated during the repair of a break near the repeat.
Okay, wait a second, though. If SDMMEJ is fundamentally error-prone, part of this emergency repair toolkit, how does it reliably generate the same sequence, like CAA, over and over again at the HTT locus? Doesn't error-prone usually just mean random junk?
That's a really critical point. It gets to the heart of the hypothesis. Yes, SDMMEJ is error-prone in the sense that it causes insertions and deletions. It's not perfect fidelity repair. But its actions are highly constrained by the local sequence environment, specifically the available microhomology sequences.
Constrained randomness.
Kind of, yeah. The sequence is present in the flanks, and maybe the first few repeats of the tract itself limit the ways Pol Theta can actually re-anneal the broken ends and restart synthesis. Only certain alignments and priming events, dictated by those short microhomology sequences, are chemically feasible. So while it might make mistakes relative to perfect repair, the types of mistakes are limited and biased by the local context.
So the errors it makes are specific to the location because the available spare parts, the microhomologies, are specific to that location.
That's a great way to put it. It's constrained by the available parts. And that brings us back to those incredibly complex alleles, like that DM1 family going from two interruptions to six.
How does SDMMEJ explain that level of complexity?
This is another area where the model fits really well. Studies looking at MMEJ repair products in other systems, like fruit flies, Drosophila, have actually documented that the mechanism can support multiple sequential rounds of priming, synthesis, and reannealing.
From a single break event?
Potentially, yes. They've seen evidence for up to six repriming events occurring during the repair of a single double-strand break.
Wow.
That provides a direct potential mechanism for how one initial break near the repeat in the germline could trigger a cascade of repair events, leading to multiple complex interruptions being generated across maybe just one or two rounds of gamete formation.
That fits the DM1 family story perfectly. Okay, that's a strong link. What about the directionality? Why are the interruptions usually near the flanks, not in the middle?
This is where the authors raise a really important possibility. It might be an observational bias.
Meaning breaks are happening in the middle, but we just don't see the results.
Potentially, yes. Imagine a double-strand break occurs right smack in the middle of a long, pure CAG repeat track. If the SDMMEJ repair process kicks in, but only uses the existing CAG sequence for its microhomology priming, and then synthesizes perfect CAG repeats to fill the gap,
then the final repaired sequence looks identical to the original pure repeat.
Exactly. The repair event happened. An insertion or deletion might even have occurred, but because it only involved the repeat sequence itself, the outcome is genetically invisible to us using standard sequencing. We wouldn't detect an interruption.
Ah, so we only see the interruption event when the break and repair happen near the flank, because that's when non-repeat sequence from the flank gets incorporated.
That's the hypothesis.
Yeah.
The repair process incorporates something different like CAA or CT from the flank, and only then do we score it as an interruption event that changes the sequence structure.
So interruptions might be forming all along the tract, but
yep.
We disproportionately detect the ones near the edges because they actually change the detectable sequence.
That seems plausible, yes. It elegantly explains the observed pattern without requiring breaks to only happen at the ends.
Okay, this SDMMEJ model seems to tie everything together quite nicely, but as you said, Aston and Dion are careful to state this is currently a well-reasoned hypothesis, a speculation, right?
Absolutely. It's a compelling synthesis and proposal. But the next critical step is empirical testing in the lab.
What are the main challenges there?
The biggest challenge is probably developing robust, cellular, or even animal models where we can actually study these complex interrupted alleles dynamically. Watching them change in real time is tough.
But the hypothesis does make some clear, testable predictions, things we could look for to either support or refute it.
Yes, it makes at least three key predictions that are, in principle, falsifiable.
Okay, what are they?
First, the model predicts that the flanking sequences are the primary determinants of the type of interruption gained.
So if we could experimentally change the flank sequence?
We should be able to change the type or frequency of interruptions that appear at that locus after inducing breaks. That would be strong support.
Makes sense. Second prediction.
Second, the entire process must require a double-strand break to get started. If interruptions can be generated efficiently without inducing breaks, the model is in trouble.
Okay, and the third?
Third, and this is crucial, DNA polymerase theta itself must be essential for these interruption dynamics, at least in mammalian systems.
Has that been tested?
The current data on pol theta's involvement, specifically in repeat instability, is a bit mixed. So more definitive work is needed to confirm its role in generating these specific interruption patterns within expanded repeats in human cells or relevant models.
Got it. And stepping back, the clinical relevance here is potentially huge, isn't it? We're talking about understanding that 40% of disease variability.
That's massive. That 40% can be the difference between someone developing severe symptoms in their 30s versus living a relatively healthy life well into their 60s or even later.
So if we could understand this mechanism well enough to actually manipulate it,
that could open up entirely new therapeutic avenues. It builds on some exciting early work using gene editing, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
There have been proof of concept studies showing you can use tools like CRISPR to edit the pathogenic CAG repeat in Huntington's cell and convert parts of it to the protective CAA sequence.
Effectively creating a good interruption to counteract the bad repeat.
Exactly. Now imagine if we understood the natural SDMMEJ process well enough. Could we perhaps encourage the cell's own machinery to stabilize beneficial interruptions or prevent the loss of existing ones?
Or maybe even selectively inhibit pol theta activity near repeats to prevent detrimental changes.
These are longer-term possibilities, but understanding the fundamental mechanism is the first step towards potentially controlling the stability and structure of these interruptions in vivo. That could permanently lessen the impact of the mutation.
So the big take-home message here seems to be that these interruptions, these tiny sequence changes within repeats, they aren't just static markers.
Not at all. They are highly dynamic, constantly being gained or lost. They are very specific to their genomic location, and they are absolutely crucial modifiers of disease severity for dozens of neurological conditions.
And the proposal that SDMMEJ, this error-prone but constrained DNA repair pathway, is driving these dynamics, provides a really unified and plausible framework.
It directly links the machinery the cell uses to handle dangerous DNA breaks to the modification of disease risk. It suggests genome instability mechanisms are even more central than we thought.
Which means we really need to move beyond just counting how long a repeat is.
Absolutely. We have to sequence through the repeats, understand their fine internal structure, map out those interruptions, and pay close attention to the flanking sequences that might be guiding their formation.
So wrapping up, what does this all mean going forward? What's the big thought-provoking implication here for, say, personalized medicine?
Well, it suggests that predicting disease course or even developing therapies might get even more complex. If the very fine structure within a pathogenic repeat is itself unstable and constantly shifting, potentially changing the disease onset across generations.
It moves the goalposts, doesn't it? It's not just about the overall length anymore.
Right. The target might shift from simply correcting the length of a repeat, which is already hard to potentially correcting or stabilizing the fine sequence structure inside the repeat.
That sounds incredibly challenging.
It is, but it also highlights this fascinating link. The background rate of DNA damage and the efficiency of specific repair pathways like SDMMEJ in an individual could directly influence their clinical fate, even if they inherited the same basic mutation as a relative.
It really underscores how dynamic the genome is and how understanding those dynamics is key.
It tells us we have to focus intently on these mechanisms of genome stability and repair. They're not just housekeeping. They're potentially major determinants of disease.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.